Hello, and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK Medical University Center. Keep getting better. I'm Raquel Williams. We're here with Dr. Christine Grease. She is the director of the Concussion Program, Traumatic Brain Injury, and is certified clinical assistant professor at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Dr. Grease is also with the Inpatient Stroke Rehabilitation Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at JFK Johnson Rehabilitation Institute. Welcome back, Dr. Grease.
Thank you for having me, Raquel. I appreciate it.
This is a subject that doesn't really get old, and I think it's worth doing every time we have the start of the new school season, talking about concussions in sports and brain and head injury when it comes to sports. Now, the kids are heading back to school and heading back to sports. We want to have fun, but of course we want them to stay safe as well. But accidents, as we all know, do happen. Concussion, as we did know, is one of them. And from what I understand, Dr. Grease, it's pretty common. So why don't we first start off in talking about what exactly a concussion is.
So mainly, Raquel, a concussion is any impact to the brain or to the rest of the body, a force that's transmitted through the brain that can cause some neurological deficits. And what that means is pretty much a wastebasket term of any change in your central or peripheral nervous system behavior. And so changes in the way that you perceive things, changes in the way that you function, whether it's physically, movement, fatiguing quickly, or whether it's mentally, so changes in your ability to process information quickly, or even psychologically, so changes in your ability to cope with stress, in your mood regulation, and then also changes in sleep cycles as well. Obviously, a concussion is something that's short-lived, hopefully it doesn't cause any permanent neurological damage, but mainly is temporary. But it does cause, obviously, some debilitating symptoms immediately after that impact.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that. What should you do when someone is showing the signs of a concussion, specifically in, say, school sports? What should the faculty and people at school do when they see this?
Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about a sign and then what we could do. So mainly, we have, we're watching a game and two athletes just kind of butt heads together. Let's say it's a contact sport, whatever it may be. One of them either falls to the ground, tries to get up, and then looks a little bit wobbly or veers towards an opposite direction of where they're supposed to go. Or they have butterfingers automatically and then they slip and they can't really catch the ball, or they're aiming in the wrong direction. And some of them can complain of a significant headache. Some of them can feel a little bit of blurry vision. So immediately, whenever we pick up these signs, in an athlete, the first thing that a coach, an athletic trainer, a parent, any spectator, a referee has to get that person out of the game. We put them on the sidelines and we let them rest, and they do not return to the game at least within 24 hours. So they're not allowed to really resume playing on that same time. And those are really the main first recommendations before we think of anything else.
Okay. So at least 24 hours. So how do you determine when it is safe for a player to return to the game?
When they are able to function normally, meaning day-to-day life, eating, drinking, walking down the street, playing their, games, taking a jog and coming back with completely no symptoms. And so as long as they have been symptom-free for 24 hours, we call it a gradual stepwise approach to returning back to their basic function. And so in some cases, that athlete will say, I had a headache and I attempted to, just go out, to the movies with my friends after the game, and I could not watch the screen. And then that night, I just slept it off. The next morning, I went for a run and I feel fine. And so I tell them, okay, let's say that they had the concussion maybe during a game at around 5 p.m. the day before. Mm-hmm. And so let's say by 5 p.m. the day after, and they are completely symptom-free and they're already back to doing everything that they're doing and they have zero symptoms. Symptoms meaning eye fatigue, eye strain, balance issues, coordination problems, trouble finding words, headaches, mood changes, sleepiness, all of those things can count as symptoms. And so if they have been symptom-free for that 24-hour period, then we say, all right, why don't you try to go back to the game? Let's see if you can run some non-contact practice drills and then contact practice drills before we clear you to go back to the next game.
I'm wondering, are there any particular tests that actually show concussion? Like if there are scans of the brain that are conducted that will show actual changes within brain activity, are there tests like that?
Well, that's a good question. We do have tests for functional MRIs that look at blood flow in certain areas based on the activity level. And so we assess if there's areas that should have blood flow that don't after a concussion. And then we guesstimate that those areas are maybe affected. And we just kind of take that educated guess. But as we know, concussion is a clinical diagnosis. And so you need to see it happen before your very eyes to call it a concussion. It's not just basically a structural diagnosis. That's why when a patient is suspected to have a severe concussion and the patient, you know, undergoes a CAT scan in an emergency room or, you know, in an outpatient center, and we do the CAT scan mainly to rule out more severe head injury or bruising, such as brain bleeds. But let's say that there is nothing on the CAT scan. It doesn't mean that the patient did not have a concussion. It just means that the concussion wasn't large enough to cause a bruised vessel for the bleeding to expand, that we could actually see it on an image. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I understand that. Now, talk about treatment of concussions. How exactly do you treat a concussion? Is it just rest and watching, or is there something else involved?
Well, it's a few steps. So we take our basic steps first, and best thing to do is relative rest. So back in the day, we used to have the cocooning effect. And, you know, families used to, after their loved ones or their kids and athletes or sports would have concussions, we would actually have them rest completely, dark room, shades down, sunglasses. I'll wake you up every 2 hours to make sure that you're still alert and, and responsive and all of that. Right now, we've gotten rid of all of those things. And we say, you know what, just go home, rest, and do the basic activities of daily living, meaning eat, sleep, and just in rest, and try to do whatever you can that's very minimal. So mainly household ambulation, movements, and just kind of take a break, meaning cut back on screens, cut back on reading, cut back on homework, cut back on social media, anything that will trigger excessive responses. And then we just tell them, all right, let's see if your symptoms get better. Now let's try to reintroduce slowly all of those things that we used to do on a day-to-day basis and see if that triggers any symptoms. And so it's a very stepwise approach, and that usually takes anywhere between 24 hours up to 72 hours where we start reintroducing. So I'll tell the patients, you know what, you miss social media, try going ahead on Facebook, but just probably or Instagram, and say, hey, you know what, let's just scroll for 10 minutes. Does it trigger any symptoms? Do you have any eye fatigue? If you do, then let's cut back. And the next day, retry it again, but this time not 10 minutes, just do it for 5. See if that triggers your symptoms. So we have something called the graduated or sub-symptom threshold training, where we are constantly getting back into our daily activities, sub-symptom or sub-maximal threshold of their symptoms, of their triggers. And then pretty much if, let's say, that doesn't work, then we start introducing where the professionals come in, the physical therapists, occupational speech therapists. What do? They pretty much put the athlete on a treadmill, and they do graduated exercise protocol. They say, you know what, we're going to work up that heart rate and watch what heart rate it takes for your symptoms to be, re-triggered. And then after that, we're going to work it to less of that degree to see. And then by doing that day in and day out for about a week or two, the body becomes almost habituated again, and you correct something called cerebral blood flow autoregulation, which is impaired after a concussion. And so by correcting that, you actually reduce a lot of their symptoms. And then we get them back in. And of course, there are also medicines to be involved, but that's really when the concussion's severe enough and the symptoms just don't get better after a few weeks.
I'm wondering if there are people that take concussions lightly. I mean, I've seen things on the field, you know, just growing up of, you know, people saying, okay, walk it off, you'll be all right. And, you know, get back in the game in another, you know, half hour or so. If concussions go untreated, what happens?
Well, we do know that something called repetitive hits to the head, subconcussive blows, if they happen frequent enough, studies tell us that we actually have a lot more subconcussive injuries in athletes during practice and during the actual game. And with all of these now over time, the brain is being used to being in a swollen state. And as a result of that swollen state, there it causes a chemical imbalance in the brain, and scar tissue is laid down prematurely, earlier than it should be laid down. And so we have something called tau protein deposits, tauopathy, which is the severe end of it. And that's where we call the term CTE kind of came into play, where these athletes are just kind of over time, over the days, over the weeks, over the months, over the years, just having these subconcussive blows. They walk it off, and then they just go back in the game. Mm. They don't take the proper rest for the swelling to come down to reduce that free radical formation that's happening in the brain. And as a result, you're going to get symptoms. And so over time, patients may start noticing that they have severe headaches, migraines that they were never genetically predisposed to. Mm-hmm. They may start noticing that they have some cognitive delay, some fatigue quickly. Some of them may develop changes in mood and behavior regulation that they never had an issue with before. And so these are things and long-term issues that we worry about. And I always like to say it as almost like a cigarette effect. It's not just, oh, that one cigarette that's going to make it or bake it, right? Mm-hmm. It's that over time cumulative effect that will over time cause problems. And we don't know exactly in every individual it's going to be different. And so we don't know when that is going to tip over, tip the brain over its edge and, mm-hmm. you know, cause irreversible damage.
Well, speaking
and everybody's different.
Right. And speaking of irreversible damage, is there any time the concussions can be fatal, or are there things from a concussion that eventually can over time lead to something fatal?
Well, concussions can be fatal if there is one concussive blow and within a few seconds to minutes, another one that can happen impactful enough where we call it second impact syndrome. Mm-hmm. And second impact syndrome is a known thing and phenomenon in athletes where the swelling in the first concussion hasn't really reduced enough to accommodate enough space in the brain for the second concussion swelling. And as a result, the brain literally just gets squeezed down in a closed container called the skull. And that causes the brain to herniate. And that is actually fatal. If it's not, the patient could either be quadriplegic or they could, you know, literally it's fatal. And that's something that we are aware of. And so we haven't allowed for the swelling to reduce from the first concussion. And that's the term where the term second impact syndrome happened. Mm-hmm. And so if it's long-term effects, we don't have it in terms of fatality, but we do know that repetitive head injuries over time, there have been a lot of publications out there now that discuss an increase in mortality mm-hmm. and a reduction in lifespan with patients who have had multiple head injuries over time.
Well, I'm wondering how concussions affect people of different ages. Say a 6-year-old suffering a blow to the head as opposed to, you know, a 60-year-old. Are they both affected the same way?
No, absolutely not. So we know, actually, the kids behave a lot more. It's a bimodal distribution. So kids and the elderly behave very similarly. And why is that? Because there is a lot more room in the skull for the brain to shake. The kid's brain are underdeveloped and immature in terms of its size. And so a kid's brain is going to be such a tiny structure with all this space between the brain and the skull versus a young adult, middle-aged individual, where there's not a lot of space between the brain and the skull. And so there's not a lot of room to shake. If there is an impact or a blow to the head, generally speaking, there is a lot more oscillation back and forth, even after that impact has happened. So it's not like, oh, the brain just, it's not just an impact to the skull, but the brain inside literally continues like a pendulum shaking back and forth for several seconds after that impact has happened and until it stops on its own. And that happens a lot in the young, the very young. So usually ages 0 to 5, 0 to 7, and in some cases up to 11 and 13 years old. And then it happens again in the elderly, so 65 and over, where because of brain atrophy as related to age, elderly patients, if they do sustain a concussion, there's a lot more room to shake through the brain to actually shake inside that skull, that skull and, or that closed container. And so the symptoms are going to be varied, of course.
Interesting. I'm wondering if there are any particular sports that pose more of a risk than others. Of course, first ones that come to mind, boxing and football, I guess, because there are, you know, contact sports that you know, can deliver some significant blows?
Well, it's mainly contact sports can pose a risk as a result because of the fact that they there is more risk of an impact, not only to the brain, not to the skull, but even to the body. So there's a lot of bodily contact. And that constant shaking and vibrations over time can definitely induce, you know, all of these symptoms. So it's one of those things. Am I going to really hone in on one sport in particular? Not really. But we do know, for instance, across the world, internationally and even nationally, we have a few contact sports that are a lot more risky and have a more pose a risk for concussions than others. You know, the football, soccer, hockey, you know, but there are other sports where I've seen patients with concussed, even as simple as swimming, where a swimmer just takes a different angle and doesn't stop before the stop end and then head buzz, you know, towards the wall of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that happen as well. But, you know, it's one of those things where we have to be aware of our surroundings and have very good spatial awareness as an athlete in order to be careful and not sustain the concussion in the first part, because prevention is the best medicine.
I'm wondering what other traumatic brain injuries can mimic a concussion. I guess sometimes things can get a bit confusing as to, well, is it a concussion? Is it something else? Are there other injuries that look like a concussion?
Well, in terms of traumatic, so concussion by definition is a mild traumatic brain injury. So other, you mean in terms of like other neurological diseases that look like concussion?
I guess I'm saying if there is a head blow and they have the symptoms, it's automatically a concussion. It's nothing else that it could possibly look like, I'm assuming.
Well, it could look like more of a severe as opposed to a concussion.
Okay.
It could be a moderate brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a bleed to the brain, which is why we do CAT scans in patients who have severe enough symptoms,
mm-hmm.
or who lose consciousness or have signs of increased intracranial pressure. And that's determined by the professional, and they can make that judgment call of doing the CAT scan or not, because it may appear initially like a concussion, but in reality it could be more of a moderate or severe brain injury where there's an actual bleed in the brain.
What's a good age for kids to start sports? I mean, I know we like to get our kids out there early as possible, but you know, you have a little league, leagues. I forgot what you call them. But what's a good age? What's a safe age, I guess I should say, for kids to start with the sports? And what should parents be concerned about, if anything?
Well, before I tell you what the age is, I'll tell you this. And I've said this in many different conferences, lectures before. About 90% of Hall of Famers in the football realm didn't really start practicing before the age 11. And I want to put it out there. And that's a very big and strong statement. So what it's saying is, yes, we want our kids to be in sports. Yes, I do want my kids to be healthy. I'd rather, when we want our kids to play around, we have to let kids be kids. We have to let kids try and work their athleticism up in terms of their training, their conditioning levels, before they're really ready to play in an organized team. And when they do play in an organized team, it's more important, as opposed to just winning the game, to literally talk about just purely technique. The focus should be on technique. The focus should be on, did I win because of my technique? Because technique is key, and strengthening muscles is key. And patients, athletes, are more prone to injury after quarantine, for instance, because they were more deconditioned. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Conditioning prevents a lot of injuries because form and technique are always put at preference. And so when it comes to starting organized sports and teams, we really should wait until that brain and that skull analogy that I was talking about earlier. We should really wait for the brain and the skull to kind of come closer together when it comes to brain development, so that even if their concussion does happen, there's not a lot of room for the brain to shake,
mm-hmm.
and less incidences of impact than concussion. And which is the reason why other countries have actually been ahead of the game with us in terms of reducing increasing the age at when contact sports should be initiated. And guidelines are coming out, you know, a perfect example, Canada just, you know, went up on its age to start hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, it used to be 10 and 11, now it's 13. And there's a reason for that, because of that brain's ability and the reduction in concussion symptoms. But when it comes to sports should, you know, we should start sports. We should keep our kids always active and healthy. But we have to intervene. But we should really wait a little bit longer until they can get the technique right first.
Well, Dr. Greece, of course, you are an expert when it comes to kids and youth sports and the injuries that can happen as a result. And as we know, concussion is, of course, not the only injury that can happen on the field. As we've seen recently in the news, that there were a couple of students that actually passed away due to excessive heat practicing and playing organized sports in excessive heat. Now, that's just awful.
Right. So the reason, I mean, as I mentioned before, concussion is really much of the brain is swollen, mm-hmm. right? And so it's not just a structural issue, but it's really, there's a lot of swollen tissue. Now, when we introduce heat in the picture, heat obviously dilates or expands blood vessels mm-hmm. even more. And imagine if there is a swollen brain to begin with, there will be almost a risk of increased swelling after exposure to heat in the setting of a concussion. Mm-hmm. And so, as you can see, that's a double whammy. It's detrimental. Right. You know, a patient, really, even if you think about it from any other aspect in life, whenever, for instance, our knee is swollen or whenever our ankle or whatever other joint in the body is swollen, mm-hmm. and that joint has actually a lot of room to expand in that swelling because it's not encapsulated by closed containers such as the skull. Mm-hmm. But whenever we do that, the first thing we do is ice, right? Because mm-hmm. we have to reduce blood flow and all of that excessive swelling. But if we introduce heat, an excessive amount of heat, or more activity, aerobic activity, and more blood flow after a patient has or an athlete has underwent a concussion, that's detrimental. Mm-hmm. And that is the reason why it could be fatal.
You know, I think there's some lessons that we all can learn from some of our Olympic heroes that, you know, were embroiled in some controversy for actually stepping away when it became too much. But that's probably something that can be beneficial. I know we like to push our kids. I know coaches like to push the students. But, you know, I guess there probably is a line somewhere. There's a limit somewhere where, you know, perhaps it's too much. This is too hot. I feel like this could be dangerous. I have to step away. What do you say to that?
Right. I agree. I mean, nobody will know our bodies as much as we do. And whenever we do have that sense that this is dangerous, we need to follow our gut feeling. And at the end of the day, the gut, which I always joke about, is actually our first brain, because actually 90% of our serotonin is made in the gut, not the brain. And so when our gut tells us that, you know, something is wrong, this is too much on my body, that's when we know to step away. And it's important to teach our kids to follow our gut feeling, not just in concussions, but safety overall. And I think that's a big deal. And it's important that we are more aware of that because I feel that sometimes the competitiveness and the nature of that right now or the sports and the teams and the Olympics, sometimes we lose sight of the whole benefit of the Olympics and what it stands for. And we just think about the competitiveness piece of it, which, you know, may or may not be beneficial.
Right. Exactly. Wow. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Christine Grice. She is director of the concussion program, traumatic brain injury, and is also a certified clinical assistant professor at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Dr. Grice is also with the inpatient stroke rehabilitation department of physical medicine and rehab at JFK Johnson Rehabilitation Institute. For more information on what they've got going on over at JFK, you can log on to jfkjohnson.org. And more importantly, as the kids head out to do the different sports, make sure that everyone keeps safety first and safety at top of mind. Dr. Grice, thank you so much for your time. As always, you're welcome here on the program and always a wealth of information.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Raquel. Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity.